supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. This morning, police killed the man who they say gunned down a 32-year-old Delaware state trooper on Wednesday. State police held a news conference this afternoon releasing more details about how all of this transpired, and WHYY's Shirley Min tells us more.
A nearly 20-hour standoff in Delaware ended at 9:17 this morning when police shot and killed Bergen Seeley Jr. The 26-year-old came out of his Middletown home armed and, quote, engaged police. Seeley is accused of gunning down a Delaware state trooper in a Wawa parking lot about 15 miles away. State Police Superintendent Nathaniel McQueen says Corporal Stephen Ballard approached a parked car around noon yesterday with two men he believed were acting suspiciously. Seeley was in the passenger seat. McQueen says when Ballard asked Seeley to get out of the car, a struggle ensued. Then Seeley pulled a gun and started firing at Ballard.
Corporal Ballard attempted to run for cover behind a parked vehicle. However, Seeley pursued him, and the suspect fired a handgun, striking him in the upper body. Corporal Ballard immediately went to the ground. The suspect then fired multiple rounds at close range, again striking him in the upper body.
McQueen says Seeley then sped off in his gray Honda.
The suspect had made contact with family members and advised that he had shot a trooper at the Wawa. The family immediately relayed that information to police.
That tip led police to the home in the quiet, manicured Brick Mill Farms development where Seeley barricaded himself overnight. Delaware Governor John Carney expressed his condolences for law enforcement across the state.
I stand before you with an aching heart, a heart that aches for Corporal Ballard, his wife, his daughter, a heart that aches for the Delaware State Police who served with him.
Police would not say in what way the suspects raised Ballard's suspicions. McQueen would only say the investigation is ongoing. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Shirley Min, WHYY News.
The NFL draft gets underway tonight at 8. The Art Museum area has been transformed. And WHYY's Joe Hernandez is there and joins us live to tell us all about it. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mary.
Go ahead.
I've been here all afternoon, and the crowd has only gotten larger. There are thousands of people up and down the Ben Franklin Parkway up to the Art Museum steps where the stage is set up. It's kind of got a feel of a music festival for sports fans. There are vendors everywhere, food and drink. Of course, there's plenty of beer. But there's also activities for people to do, including kids. There's virtual reality. There's a zip line. And there's a spot, and this one had a long line, where you could kick a regulation field goal. There have also been some celebrity athlete sightings. Eagles QB Carson Wentz was out here taking pictures with fans. And when a fan would go up with an Eagles jersey, everyone would cheer. And when basically they were wearing any other jersey, fans would boo. The stage is huge. And if you're looking straight at it, it's hard to know that the Art Museum is behind it, except for the fact that the NFL is using the Rocky Steps and the columns as a backdrop. There are probably about 10 or 12 screens broadcasting logos and live feeds and countdowns to the draft. And the fans here came from all over the country. I talked to one guy who was a Miami Dolphins fan who came in from Boise, Idaho. But as you would expect, there are a lot of Eagles fans here too, a lot of Eagles fans, including the guy who calls himself the number one Eagles fan, Monty G, who is here.
I'm happy. NFC Champions this year is going good, baby. We're going to look good. We're going to represent. It ain't nothing but the Super Bowl, baby. No ifs, ands, or buts, or maybe. Have all the Eagles fans going crazy because my Eagles are the best, baby, baby. E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles.
Well, it sounds like there's an awful lot of excitement there, Joe. That's inside the parkway. How are folks feeling about all this, though, outside the venue?
Yeah, so I and our photographer campaigner took a stroll outside the grounds here. We went into the Fairmount neighborhood, which is adjacent to this area, to talk to some people because there had been reporting that some neighbors weren't thrilled with the fact that this big event was coming here and shutting down roads all day. We caught up with one couple that was people watching from their stoop, and they said it wasn't a bad thing that it was coming here. But another guy I spoke to, Fairmount resident Alex David, said he didn't really know which streets were going to be open and which were closed, except for what he read in the newspaper.
It's been difficult because the roads keep changing every couple days before you get your arms around it. It's changed again.
All right. Well, yeah, there is a real tough side to it. Back to the fun stuff for just a moment, Joe. I do have to ask you, you think you're going to do the zip line as part of the reporter's experience?
I think I might. I think I might before I come back in.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Joe Hernandez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
The NFL draft has taken over most of the parkway, as we just heard, as well as the famous rocky steps that lead to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, completely blocking the entrance to the museum. The museum will remain open during its regular hours throughout the draft through its west side entrance at the rear of the building near the Schuylkill River. As WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports, art is having a hard time competing with football.
The Art Museum has had to deal with many major events at its front door, including the annual 4th of July concerts, the Made in America Music Festival, a visit by the Pope. The museum's chief operating officer, Gail Harity, says there are events on the parkway 33 out of 52 weeks a year, but this one is different.
The scope of the NFL draft and the build-out is, I would say, much greater than previous events on the parkway, so it does have an impact.
The massive scale of the staging, which consumes all of the rocky steps and the entrance plaza, along with support crew and security fencing, have shut down all roads surrounding the museum except for the Spring Garden Bridge behind the building. Dan Felder, on vacation from San Francisco, is a lifelong 49ers fan, but wanted nothing to do with NFL hype on his visit to the museum.
Yeah, I think it's a little absurd, but you know, we walked along the river, so it wasn't that hard to avoid it.
Felder was one of the few people visiting the museum today. A security guard who did not want to be recorded said the number of visitors was definitely down. Right now, the Art Museum has its own MVP exhibition, a huge show chronicling the development of American watercolor art.
The American watercolor.
It was great. It was really good.
A charter bus from Somerset, New Jersey, brought this group of ladies to view rarely seen watercolors by artists like John Singer Sargent and Winslow Homer.
And you only know them from some of their art, but it was just fabulous.
One of these women is Deborah Leibovitz, who said they booked this trip months ago.
We're, you know, Jerseyites, New Yorkers, nothing bothers us. We just go.
Leibovitz and her friends came to see the watercolors, but they're keeping one eye on the NFL draft because they are longtime players of suicide pool, where they bet on football teams each week. So the draft is important to them.
It is important to us. We want to know who's going to be the quarterback for the Jets. I always kid around and say it's going to be Vinny Testaverde again, because every time they needed somebody, they took him out of the woodwork.
Will the Jets pick up Deshaun Watson from Clemson University for its rookie quarterback, or maybe Mitchell Trubisky from North Carolina? The watercolor ladies will be taking their charter bus back to Somerset, New Jersey, to follow the draft from home. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Pennsylvania House of Representatives passed a bill this week that would revise the state's 20-year-old charter school law. The changes are being hotly debated as it moves to the Senate for consideration. Advocates for traditional schools are upset about many things that the bill does not address, including reforms for how charter schools are paid for their special education students. For Keystone Crossroads, Bill Hangley takes us to Chester Upland, where a quirk in the existing law has nearly bankrupted the distressed southeastern Pennsylvania district.
The flag of the United States of America and into the republic for which we stand.
Welcome to Chester, Pennsylvania, where the local school board is about to do what no board wants to do, raise taxes.
We thought we had to do it, and we had done it the past 4 years, because we keep asking the state to give us more. You know, the board's mindset is like, no, we got to stand up, you know, and do for self, too.
Anthony Johnson is the board president of the Chester Upland School District, where costs have been growing unsustainably for years. Among the biggest drivers are the payments the district must make to charter schools for special education students. After Johnson explained Chester's latest tax increase, community advocate Jean Arnold made a plea to bring those special ed students back to the district.
We have such a drain on special ed students. But if we could stop that drain and bring those students back, I'm asking...
Johnson likes that idea. He says that by getting special ed students out of cyber charters, Chester Upland could cut its deficit by a third.
This year we're coming after the cyber children. So if we can get 50 back, that's over $2 million. You know, that's revenue. You got to look at it as revenue.
In the tangled world of Pennsylvania public school financing, special education payments to charters are a particularly thorny problem. They're not calculated based on the actual costs of services, which can vary widely depending on need. Instead, all disabilities are treated equally, and even when special ed students have only modest needs, charters get paid as if the students had much more severe disabilities. State data shows that students with modest needs tend to end up in charters, and that leaves costlier students in traditional district schools, draining district budgets. Chester Upland has become the poster child for this phenomenon. It spends about $16,000 a year for its own special ed students, but by law, it must pay its charters more than twice that for the exact same students.
You know, there's no way that this was the intent of legislators when they wrote this charter school law.
Susan Spica is the executive director of Education Voters PA, an advocacy group pushing to revise a law that she says can hurt both districts and charters.
Charter schools are overpaid for students who have disabilities that require low-cost services, and then they're underpaid for students with disabilities who require more intensive services.
Spica would like to see payments driven by the actual cost of services, but reform efforts like hers have failed before.
I call it a cash cow for the charter and charter cyber schools.
That's State Representative Bernie O'Neill, a Bucks County Republican and former special ed teacher. In 2013, O'Neill was part of a legislative commission that estimated that charters were overpaid for special ed by about $200 million in taxpayer funds. He still gets mad just talking about it.
Oh, my God, don't tell me it's costing you $42,000 to educate any student. I'm sorry. You can go to Villanova almost for that amount of money.
O'Neill's commission also called for costs to be tied to actual needs, but lobbying from the charter sector helped kill those reforms. Charter proponents say that even if the current system lacks logic, any overpayments help balance out what they see as underpayments in other areas. And in fact, by law, charters are permitted to use special ed dollars for almost anything they want. Max Tribble is a spokesperson for the Chester Community Charter School.
I'm not an expert on special education funding, but I can tell you that the funding has always been designed to go into a pool to provide for all students in the school.
Tribble says the current law is basically a fair one, but he understands the problems it creates for district budgets. By last year, Chester Upland's financial situation was so bad that Chester Community Charter agreed to accept lower special ed payments. But the district's cyber charters refused to accept those same cuts, and they still get over $40,000 for every special ed student they enroll.
I don't think that is fair. We felt like we made cuts in order to have a fair agreement with the district. The cybers didn't.
Tribble says Chester Community Charter can still provide good services even with the payment cuts. Susan Spica of EdVoters says Pennsylvania needs to take a careful look at charters statewide to find out where special ed funds are really needed.
There probably are some charter schools that very much rely on this funding just to keep their operations going so that they can give kids what they need. But I think there probably are other charter schools that are doing just fine, and they're taking this excess special education funding, and it's going someplace where it's not benefiting students.
Spica is just one of a number of advocates and lawmakers who've been calling for change, but leaders in the state legislature haven't made the issue a priority. Reform is not part of the current debate over the state charter school law, and that leaves hard-hit districts like Chester Upland with two choices: either raise more money through local taxes or find more spending to cut. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Bill Hangley.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania's cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. An historic African-American cemetery in Camden County is in a fight for its life. WHYY's Dana DiFilippo has the story.
Take a walk into Mount Peace Cemetery, and at first glance, you might not notice anything wrong. American flags flutter over old graves, birds sing from trees overhead. The cemetery seems like a refuge from the busy highways nearby. But look closer and you see problems. Graves have sunk, leaving the ground dangerously uneven. Trees and weeds have taken over in some areas, swallowing some tombstones completely. Trash is everywhere.
We even had a sinkhole in the middle of the cemetery at one point that was about 15 feet deep when we looked at it. It just opened up.
That's Yolanda Romero. She's part of a dwindling but passionate group of preservationists that has worked hard for decades to restore Mount Peace. Most, like Romero, are senior citizens, and they're no match for Mother Nature, who relentlessly reclaims her land. As bad as things are now, Romero says, they used to be worse. The cemetery was founded in 1902 as a burial ground for African Americans excluded from whites-only graveyards. It's now the final resting place for thousands of people, many of whom were former slaves and veterans of conflicts dating back to the Civil War. But in the 1950s, its original owner went bankrupt, and the cemetery's records got destroyed in a fire. By the 1970s, people were using the cemetery as a dump, says Lawnside Mayor Marianne Wardlow.
It was terrible. It was an eyesore.
Wardlow participated in the early cleanups. She remembers volunteers hauling an old boat, a broken stove, and all sorts of junk out of the cemetery. Occasional cleanups weren't enough, though, to maintain order. People still litter, trees and weeds keep growing. It's not a battle Mount Peace wages alone. Robert Fells heads the International Cemetery, Cremation, and Funeral Association.
Cemeteries are unique in that they service what they sell, you know, forever. Nobody else does that. I mean, you might get a 5-year warranty on something and then the seller is done, you know. But cemeteries, it's an ongoing obligation to basically to maintain the grounds, you know, forever. And you know, that's a long time.
It's an especially long time when you have no money. Mount Peace does have a $100,000 preservation fund, but state law forbids cemeteries from touching the principal. Trustees can only spend the fund's earnings. But Romero says last year, Mount Peace's preservation fund earned just $16 in interest. And the cemetery closed for burials 10 years ago, so no new money comes in from selling plots.
It's just a matter of money. I mean, the bottom line is we're broke.
For now, Romero has no answers for how this century-old cemetery will survive another 100 years. For WHYY News, I'm Dana DiFilippo.
The life and legacy of Daniel Alexander Payne Murray, the first African-American Assistant Librarian of Congress, will be honored in a ceremony tomorrow afternoon at the Library of Congress. Dr. Craig Stutman, Assistant Professor of History and Policy Studies at Delaware Valley University, and co-chair of the Toni Morrison Society's Bench by the Road Project, joined Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller to discuss the project's efforts to preserve African-American history.
Dr. Stutman, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Tell us about Murray.
Well, Murray is the first assistant librarian of Congress for the Library of Congress from the late 19th century, and he worked into the early 20th century as well. The significance of his life is multifaceted. He was a history writer. He organized the Paris Exposition with W.E.B. Du Bois in 1900. And this was the famous, what they called the Negro Exhibit of 1900, studying African-American life and culture abroad at that World's Fair. And he also was an archivist and a librarian and a very important figure in terms of collecting and preserving the stories of African-American history at a time when most institutions were not doing so.
Was he singular, or were there others of his renown and ability who were doing similar work in other parts of the country?
Well, Alfonso Schomburg, who had come after him and follow in his footsteps, although as not a professionally trained librarian, was a collector of African-American literature, history, science, an archivist in his own right, a librarian who started the Schomburg Library of African-American Literature, which was part of the New York Public Library system. Other than that, we're talking about a field of a number of African-American historians like Du Bois, who was certainly a contemporary of Murray at the time, also writing, preserving, and interested in the popular culture of African-Americans as well with that exposition.
And so how did the Toni Morrison Society come about?
Well, the Toni Morrison Society started as a literary society in the early 1990s. They currently and have for several decades now held Toni Morrison panels at the American Literary Association meetings. After Toni Morrison's Nobel Prize, they formed around not only talking about her work and preserving her work and being intellectual critics of her work, but also to branch out and had a number of educational pursuits that were affiliated with the society over the years. The Bench by the Road project came into play in 2006 when it was thought that the society should take a public history role and that there was, and Toni Morrison as well, was interested in the ideas of public history and having some kind of memorials.
Were you already involved when, for example, a previous bench was designated at the Eden Cemetery in Collingdale?
I was involved with the bench that we installed there, the bench and plaque that we installed there.
Remind listeners of the significance of that historic cemetery.
Eden Cemetery, they were interested in receiving a bench. Sites will apply, and then there's a board of scholars who looks at the applications and goes through the nominations and accepts. And Eden was really such a significant place in terms of who is buried there, the origin story of the cemetery itself being founded from cemeteries that were reinterred here in the city in the late 19th century and early 20th century, also as a place for African-American burials in a segregated landscape. And the history is just stunning. It goes back to the 19th century because of those reinterments, William Still and others. But you also have Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. You have Marian Anderson in the 1990s. You have Octavius Caddo. You have Charles Tinley associated with the Tinley Temple. The list really does go on and on in terms of the significance of that historic site.
In addition to the Collingdale site, are there others in the Philadelphia region?
There are. Lincoln University was just chosen, and a bench was installed and plaque was installed there several years ago. And that was focusing on the historic African-American farming community of Hinsonville out in Oxford, Pennsylvania, which eventually became consolidated into Lincoln University. So the bench was a kind of a two-part bench to the historic farming community, a memorial that was signifying that historic farming community, and also one that was signifying the birth and origin of Lincoln University as an African-American institution of higher education. We have a bench in Middletown, Delaware, for Samuel D. Burris, an African-American abolitionist who worked throughout the state of Delaware, also ushering those who were enslaved or running away to freedom in states like Pennsylvania. Two states like Pennsylvania and Delaware was a middle ground state, as it was a slave state. And that was a story that I think is significant, connects back up in a way to the Lincoln University area because of that corridor to through Westchester, Chester County, and then Westchester in terms of the Underground Railroad.
Dr. Stubman, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you very much, Dave.
That's Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller speaking with Dr. Craig Stubman, Assistant Professor of History and Policy Studies at Delaware Valley University and co-chair of the Toni Morrison Society's Bench by the Road Project. That's all for tonight's show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for Newsworks Tonight.